We are holding on Kuf Yud Aleph Amud Beis, the last line. We're in the middle of various miscellaneous pieces of advice that the Gemara is giving about things that can, about things that if a person does them, they can lead to bad consequences. Before we were talking about things involving Shadim and involving Kishuv. So some of the other things we're talking about over here also still involve Shadim or Ruchos Royce or whatever, and some of them are more general. So the Gemara says, the awful tafli, if a person eats cress, a cress is a type of vegetable that has a sharp, peppery flavor to it, that you find it mentioned in many places in Chas. Anyway, if a loy moshi yode, if he doesn't wash his hands, the Gemara doesn't specify whether it means washing his hands before or after. Anyway, mafid tlosin yomin, the person now is going to suffer from, he's going to be afraid without knowing why, he's just going to have some kind of irrational fear for the next 30 days. Dimasukar, if a person has blood let, in particular Rashi and the Rashbam say, means he has blood left from his shoulders, because in those days, you know, they would do bloodletting every so often, and the particular place to do it was on the shoulder. If he doesn't wash his hands afterwards, then he's going to suffer from a fear that he does, again, where he doesn't know the cause of it, for 7 days. If a person has a haircut and doesn't wash his hands, then he's going to have this kind of irrational fear for 3 days. And the shakel toifre vele mashi yode, and if a person cuts his fingernails and doesn't wash his hands, mafkid chad yoma, then he's going to be afraid for 1 day. And in all those cases, vele yode maiko mafkid. In all those cases, he's not going to know what he's afraid of. He's just going to have this unreasonable, nameless fear without knowing what it is that he's fearing. So therefore, in other words, the point is, it's important to wash your hands after all these things. And in fact, I don't know about the quests, but at least as far as the bloodletting and the hair cutting and the nail cutting, it mentions in Shulchan Aruch, it mentions a list of times after which a person should wash their hands, and all three of those are on that list. Okay. Continues the Gemara. Yoda Ausia, if a person regularly puts his hand on his upper lip near his nose, Dargalapachta, that is a step towards fear. In other words, it brings him a ruach ra of fear. Yoda apusa, and if a person puts his hand on his forehead, daga l'shensa, it's a step towards sleep. So it can mean that those kinds of things tend to bring certain ruchos rois on him. It can mean that a person who habitually puts their hand on their upper lip by their nose, which is a way of expressing fear, so that itself makes them more fearful. And the same thing with the other one. The Aruch actually says it the other way around, that when a person is fearful, it's natural for them to put their hand by their nose, like as if to protect their mouth. And when a person is feeling sleepy, then it's natural for them to put their hand on their forehead. So in other words, according to the Aruch, the cause and effect are the other way around. Another thing, Tana, we learn in a Braisa, Oichon Mashkin Takas Amita, if there's food or drink under a bed, Afilu Mechupin Bekli Barzel, even if they're covered with an iron, even if they're covered inside an iron box, Ruach Rosh, Shor Alein, a bad spirit rests on them, and therefore, in other words, you shouldn't do that. You shouldn't put food under the bed. One idea is, because we know that sleep is one, the Gemara mentions in Brachas, that sleep is 1/60th of death, so therefore it's like it gets in a little bit of Tumas Mes, so to speak. One thing it does mention in that connection, when we're talking about when it's something which is, you know, a purpose-made bed, we're not talking about, for example, let's say you're on an airplane, and you put your carry-on under the seat in front of you, and then at some point during the flight, the guy in front of you goes to sleep, that's not counted as putting it under the bed, because that's not designed to be a bed. But we're talking about over here something that's designed to be a bed, and that people sleep on regularly. Okay. Turn it up on, we learn it in Braisa. A person should not drink water without the conditions that we're going to say soon on Tuesday nights or on Friday nights, because we're going to learn on Omer Beis actually that those are the particular times when Mazikim are out and about, and therefore they're more likely to be involved with the water over there, and therefore for the person to be harmed. The im shasa, and if a person drinks on those nights, domei b'roshei, then his blood is on his own head. In other words, he's responsible for any bad consequences that happen to him. B'pnei sakana, because of the danger. So my sakana, what kind of danger are we talking about? Ruach ra, so again, an evil spirit, a shed or something. Okay, so if eat sake, if im sake, so if a person is thirsty on Tuesday night or on Friday night, my takate, what should he do in order to protect himself? So the answer is name a shiva koilos shama David alamoy. You should say the seven koilos, the capital chav kasetilim, which has all the koil Hashem and this, koil Hashem that. That David mentioned in connection with water. Now, most of them don't have to do with water specifically. Only the first one of them is Koyel Hashem Alamoyim. But we're calling them the Shiva Koyelas Sha'ama David Alamoyim because that's the first one of them. So you should say that, and that will protect him. V'hadar Nishti, and then he can drink. As we learned yesterday, Tosfos says you can't use Divrei Torah for refuah, but you can use Divrei Torah for protection, as in this case, where you're doing it in order to protect yourself against the mazikim that otherwise might harm. Shenema, what are the seven koilas? It says in the pasuk, Koil Hashem alamoyim, the voice of Hashem is over the water. Kela kovid hirim, Hashem of glory thunders. Hashem amayim rabim, Hashem is over the great waters. Koil Hashem bakoyach, the voice of Hashem is with power. Koil Hashem behadur, the voice of Hashem is with glory. Koil Hashem shover arozim, the voice of Hashem breaks the cedars. By shaber Hashem is azi alavonin, Hashem breaks the cedars of Levonin, which the cedars in Levonin are very tall and strong, and yet the voice of Hashem was saying is stronger than them. And a couple of psukim later, Koil Hashem chotzev lahavesesh, the voice of Hashem carves out flames of fire. Koil Hashem yachol midbar, the voice of Hashem makes the desert tremble. Yachol Hashem midbar kodesh, Hashem makes the desert of kodesh tremble. Koil Hashem yichol layolis, the voice of Hashem makes the female deer give birth. Vayechsef yoris, and strips the forest bare. Uvehechole, and in his palace, kulay omer kovid, everything says glory to Hashem. So those are the seven koilos. Marshall points out, by the way, the Gemara mentions elsewhere that the seven brachos that we say in Shabbos and Yom Tov davening correspond to those shiva kolos. So now you say those, and that protects him against the shadim that would otherwise harm him. The Eloi, now if not, meaning either if he doesn't know that capital, for example, or maybe let's say he might even be in a place where he's not allowed to say Torah. Let's say he's in a place where there's human waste or something. Name a hochi, then let him say like this. Lul shofan and nigran and nudafim. It's a lahash, it's a spell. Bein klichvi yosivna. I sit among the stars. Bein bli shmini alzilna. I go among them. There are thin people and fat people. Meaning, in other words, in effect, you're telling the shadim, there are lots of skinny people and lots of fat people around here. Go away, don't bother me, and go bother them instead. The Eloi, if not, let's say he doesn't know that lachash, if there's somebody else with him on Tuesday night or on Friday night when he wants to drink, nit'are, then he should wake him up, the lemale, and tell him, planya bat planza, ploini ben ploinis, so call him by his name and his mother's name, sachina maya, I'm thirsty for water, v'hodr nishti, and then you can drink, because then, in effect, what you're doing is you're making the shed aware that there's somebody else with you. In fact, Ben Yehuda says, you're adding his mother's name, so it makes the shed think that his mother is there as well, and therefore, once you have many people there, then shadim are less likely to be active and to try to harm people. The Eloi, what if none of the above work, let's say he doesn't have somebody with him, Mekautish Nachtama Chatzva, then what he should do is he should rattle the lid on top of the barrel, the Hodr Nishvi, and then drink. Because that rattling again makes the shed think that there's somebody else there. The Eloi, and if not, Nishti Bamidi, Bahadur Nishti, then he should put something in the water and then drink from it. It's interesting, actually, the Alter Rebbe brings this din in his Shulchan Aruch, in Hilchos Shmiras Gufa Nefesh. He doesn't mention all of these different things. He just mentions the last one about putting something into the water before you drink it. Okay, I mean, in general, most of these things involving shadim, we're not really careful with nowadays, but the Gemara does mention in Chulin that at least before you drink some water, you should pour out a little bit in case a shed drank from it, and we see people nowadays do that also. I've seen among a lot of Lubavitcher Chassidim that do that. They do pour out a little bit. That seems to be the one shed-related thing that we still do nowadays. Even that, the Velt doesn't usually do that.
Okay. These different tricks you're saying that the shed is going to think this, the shed is going to think that. The shed, is that human to see what's going on next to you? They don't know.
I mean, the Shadim are half human, half Malachim, the Gemara tells us in Chagiga. But apparently the idea is the Gemara knows that these kinds of things will trick the Shed into thinking that there are other people there, or at least maybe that you have the source of that other person with you or whatever, and therefore they're less likely to attack. The truth is, I mean, with this whole Gemara over here, I think I mentioned before, the Me'iri, the Chalal takes a very rationalistic view of all this thing involving Shadim and Mazikim and Tishruf and whatever. According to him, a lot of it is the power of suggestion. When a person feels that something is dangerous, that itself has a bad effect on him. So therefore, like a person is going to drink on these nights where there's a popular notion that there are Shadim around, then he's more likely to be fearful, and that itself is more likely to harm him. But if he does one of these things, then the idea is that itself will make him more confident and brave, and therefore he's less likely to be affected by that kind of thing.
I don't understand the notion of Shed. If Hashem wants to send a malach to kill someone and do anything else he wants with that person, he does, and nothing can stop that. So
you tell me, by the same token, then, if I check, so you tell me, then why do you have to be careful when you cross the street? Why do you have to be careful around strangers or whatever? I mean, if Hashem wants, then it's going
to
happen.
Hashem
wants you to be careful. So Hashem created these Shadim, and Hashem gave them certain powers. Hashem also told you to be careful around them and to take whatever steps are necessary
in order to see a car. You cannot see a Shed.
Okay,
how can you be careful
with
a Shed?
Nevertheless, the idea is we're saying they are around. Okay, look, I mean, you could say the same thing. You don't see bacteria or viruses either, right? You have to take elementary steps in order to protect yourself against them. So here it's the same kind of thing. Yeah, if the Eibishter wants, then a certain virus or a certain bacterium is going to kill a person regardless of what he does. But you still have to make the effort. You still have to make the Kavi. And then the rest is in the Eibishter's hands. So it's the same thing over here. Okay, let's go on. Turn it up on him.
Sounds like you find a bit of magic, to tell you the truth.
Well, obviously the Torah tells us magic is also, but on the other hand, here you have things that the Chachamim themselves are telling us. So obviously these things are not magic of the kind that's also in the Torah. These are more things like spells and whatever. Okay, I mean, we talked about the other day also that Amman Bechlal holds similar to the Me'iri. That's where the Me'iri gets it from. That most of these things are not really actual things that exist in the world. They're just, people have vivid imaginations, and people come up with all kinds of things like this, and therefore, but nevertheless, fine. If a person is feeling fearful, of these kinds of things, so the Chachamim are giving him some kind of thing to help him feel more confident and help him feel more able to face life. And there can also be, with a lot of these things, there can be deeper lessons in them also. We don't really have what those deeper lessons are because the Mefarshim don't give them to us, but we ourselves might be able to think and come up with ideas of what they represent. Okay, onward. Turn it up on him. Lo yishta adam mayim, lo min anaharis, lo min ahagamim balayim. Now, also, a person should not drink water from rivers or from ponds at night. Now, there's Gemara in Avodah Zarah, actually, that mentions a different point, that even during the day, a person has to be careful when he's drinking from rivers and ponds, not to put his mouth directly to the water or to scoop up the water with both hands, because he may accidentally swallow a leech, and that could endanger him. Here we're not talking about there's the problem of that you might swallow a leech, but there's the problem that at night in general, besides the Tuesday nights and Friday nights that we were saying before about Mazikim, there's also a different issue on every night, the Imshasa Domei Berosha, that a person drinks on any night from ponds or rivers, Domei Berosha, then his blood is on his own head, Sakona, because of danger. Now this time, my Sakona, what's the danger this time? And the answer is Sakona Shabriv. The danger of shabriri. Shabriri is blindness. And what we're saying is, what it seems the Gemara is going to be saying is, again, that there's a certain shed that can cause a person to go blind as a result of drinking water like that. So before we were talking about on Tuesday nights and Friday nights, we meant even from a container. Here we're talking about dafka from a river or a pond. That applies every night because of this danger of shabriri. So the Gemara asks, "Tzachi maitakante?" Again, if a person is thirsty, what should he do? So again, if there's somebody else with him, You should say to him, Pliny ben Plinus, I'm thirsty for water, and then it'll be safe for him to drink, because that will get rid of the shed. The Eloi, and if not, if there's nobody else there, name it Ihu Lanafshe, then he should say to himself the following Lachash, Plania. He should say to himself, Pliny, mention his own name, Omrili Imi, my mother told me, is Dahar Mishabri. Be careful of Shabri. Then what you say is, you say the following lahash, where each time you're taking off one letter of the name. Shabriri, griri, riri, yiri, ri. By reducing the name of the shed, by going down letter by letter from the shed name, that makes the shed be afraid and run away. So you finish off. Sachinamaya bakati chivari. I'm thirsty for water. I'm thirsty for water in white earthenware cups. White can also mean new. The point is, in other words, that this way it's a lachash, and that way it gets rid of the shabriri, yeah, of the shabriri shed. Okay. Again, I mean, nowadays we're generally not worried about shedim, so generally most of these things don't apply. The one about not drinking water because of the danger of shabriri, that is mentioned. The Alter Rebbe does mention that, and he mentions the idea of putting something into the water and then drinking. We said in the Mishnah, going back now all the way to the first Mishnah of our Perek. All of this Gemara, we started the Perek on Sadek Kesem and Beis, and all this time we've been dealing with different things and digressions and all related to the Mishnah. So the Mishnah had told us that a person has to have four kosas on Pesach night, which is what got us into this whole discussion of zugos and shadim and all that kind of thing. And the Mishnah had mentioned, afilu min ha-tamchoi, that even if a person is being supported by the tamchoi, which is the collection of food that the gabari tzedakah do and give out to the really poor aniyim, even then, even if a person is in that condition, still he has to have four kosas of wine on Pesach night. So the Gemara says, Pshita, isn't that obvious? Of course, if everybody has a mitzvah to have four kosas on Pesach night, then that means everybody, whether they're rich or poor. What's the point of mentioning it? The answer is, le-mitzvah el-afilu l-Rav Akiva. The answer is, the chiddush of it is according to Rav Akiva. De-Omar, where Rav Akiva says, which we're going to learn in the Gemara tomorrow as well, asei shabbat chachol ba'al titzarech labrius. Make your Shabbos like a weekday rather than have to come to need help from other people. Nevertheless, hacha mishum pirsumei nisa, but over here, because there's a matter of publicizing the nest of Yitzias Mitzrayim, and therefore they have to have four kosas, moidi, then Rabbi Akiva would agree that in that case you should take tzedakah in order to have dalid kosas. So this matter of asei shabbat chachol is actually a little bit, it's not quite so simple as that. Tosfos on the next daf, where the Gemara brings this again, about asei shabbat chachol, mentions, on the other hand, you have a Gemara in Beitza that says that whatever a person spends on Shabbos and Yom Tov is not counted towards his annual income. In other words, Hashem figures out how much a person needs for the year, but the amount that he spends on Shabbos and Yom Tov and certain other expenses of mitzvahs are not counted towards that, so spend as much as you can. Also, the Gemara says, borrow money on my behalf, and Hashem says, I will pay back. So what do we mean over here? I say Shabbat Chachov al Tzarech Labrius. There's a bit of discussion about it in the Torah and in the Shulchan Aruch at the beginning of Hilchos Shabbos. One idea is that when we say over here, I say Shabbat Chachov al Tzarech Labrius, is let's say you have a person who he has enough money for two meals, but on Shabbos you're supposed to have three meals. Or he has enough for two plain meals, and on Shabbos, as we're going to say in a second, you're supposed to have something extra. So therefore, so one way of understanding it might be, as some of the Mephoshim say, that it would mean that he'd be allowed to take tzedakah in order to have that little something extra for the Shabbos meals. Others say that not, but what we mean is, if you have a person who's being supported by tzedakah, then the gabbai tzedakah are responsible to give him enough for three meals for Shabbos. But if he's not yet at the point of having to take tzedakah, but he only has enough for two meals, so then he should borrow money if he'll eventually have what to pay back, then he should do that. Now, Hashem promises that he'll pay back on your behalf, but if you don't have that, you don't have the ability to borrow money, then that's what we're saying. Don't take tzedakah. I say Shabbat Chochel, make your Shabbos like a regular weekday. Just have two meals like you would on a regular weekday rather than three like you would have on Shabbos. So all these things are kind of interlocked together, these different dinim. It mentions in Torah, by the way, that the Torah himself, the Baal of Yaakov, Balatur, Rabbeinu Yaakov, Balaturim, was very poor. And he mentions over there in the Torah that many times he discussed this point with his father, the Rosh, about what do we do? What do we do for Shabbos if we can't afford to have anything extra? So you see from that to almost Derech Agav how poor the Rosh and his family were that they even had to ask the question. But yet we see how much they devoted themselves to Torah, that we have such important Sifrei with such important explanations in Torah and Sforim and Halacha from them. Anyway, getting back to the Gemara over here, the point is Rabbi Akiva agrees that even though we're saying that in order to honor Shabbos, a person shouldn't be taking tzedakah where they have enough to eat like they would on a regular weekday, but for Pesach, because you have to have Dalet Kosis, so then a person should take tzedakah for that. So the Gemara continues, Tana de'Eliyahu, we learn in a Braisa of Yeshiva of Eliyahu. Most opinions say that this means Eliyahu Hanavi, that he came. The Gemara mentions in Ksuvas that he came and taught Rav Onan, one of the Amiroyim, what became Seder Eliyahu Rabba and Seder Eliyahu Zutta. There is an opinion in the Be'er Sheva, I think, says that actually Eliyahu is the name of an actual Tana, not Eliyahu Hanavi. Anyway, he teaches in a Braisa. Even though Rabbi Akiva is saying you should make your Shabbos like a weekday rather than needing to take tzedakah from people, but you do have to have something a little bit extra, some kind of special food for Shabbos in your house. So what's that little something? Even if all you can afford is kosa de hausina, special for Shabbos, then you should do that. Kosa de hausina is a dish where they would take small fish and fry them in their own fat with a little bit of flour. So it would be, I guess, sort of like the proto gefilte fish, I guess maybe you could say. So that at least is something extra that a person should have for Shabbos. So one idea of it is, it says in Shulchan Aruch, what it means is, in other words, let's say, so what you do is you squimp a little bit during the week. During the week, you eat a little bit less than you otherwise usually would in order to save up a little bit extra so that on Shabbos you can have kosa dehausina or some other, at least one extra special thing for in honor of Shabbos. Kiditznan, as in fact we learn in the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos about the importance of that a person has to overcome everything in order to do mitzvahs. Rabbi Yehuda ben Tema, remember? Heve as kanomer, be as bold as a leopard, the kal kanesher, as light and as easy to fly as an eagle, rots katsvi, running as fast as a deer, the giver kari, and as mighty as a lion, lasas with sonavicha shabashamayim, to do the will of your father in heaven, of Hashem. So in other words, you need to make the extra effort to have something extra for Shabbos, even if you can't afford a third meal for Shabbos, but at least you should squimp a little bit extra, or work a little bit extra during the week, or whatever, in order to earn a little bit extra to be able to have something extra special on Shabbos. What's the point of comparison with these four animals? So the Torah, actually, at the very beginning of Or HaChaim, he starts with this line of Yehuda ben Tema, and he explains that the idea is it means that you should use your whole metzios to serve Hashem. As Tanomer means, in other words, that you should have a famous thing, Al Yevesh Mitnam Al Igim, don't be embarrassed to people who make fun of you for learning Torah and keeping mitzvahs. Kal Kanesher is that you're flying, you're going to be ready to jump out of bed and be able to do what you need to. Rots Katzvi, to run with your feet to do mitzvahs. Giver Kari, to be as brave as a lion to do mitzvahs. Marsha explains also that over here, we're talking about, in the context we're talking about over here, about for a person, for example, a person who can't afford things for Shabbos, he says there are four things that might prevent a person from doing mitzvahs. Number one is if he's poor. Number two is because goyim prevent him. Number three is because by nature, his mazel is that he has certain inborn tendencies, certain inborn midas that prevent him from doing the right thing. And the fourth is a person has a yetzirah. So therefore, these four things represent how a person has to counteract all of those. As kanomer means that he has to, even if he's poor, he has to gather together a greater amount of boldness and a greater amount of energy than he otherwise would, which means even if he's poor, then he overcomes that and then squimps a little bit or works a little bit extra in order to have something for Shabbos extra. Kal Kanesher represents that if he has a bad mazel in Shamayim, still he has to fly like an eagle and overcome that. Rotz Katzvi is even if you have Rishoyim who are trying to prevent him from doing mitzvahs, he has to run away from there, from them, to a place where he's able to keep mitzvahs. And Gibur Kari is strengthen yourself against your own Yetzirah, Ezel Gibur HaKadosh Es Yitzchak. So therefore, so we see, in other words, that the person needs to be prepared to do that, to overcome and then be able to do mitzvahs even beyond what he would normally be able to do, and that means over here being able to honor Shabbos with something extra. Okay, Tana Rabbanan, we learn in a Braisa. Shiva Dvarim Siva Rabbi Akiva as Rabbi Yeshua Beno. Rabbi Akiva gave 7 instructions to his son Rabbi Yeshua. The Rashbam points out over here, you have in a number of, in many places in Shas, you have Rabbi Yeshua ben Korfa. The Rashbam says that is actually the same Rabbi Yeshua that we're talking about over here. Rabbi Akiva was bold, so Korcha means bold, and in fact, the Gemara mentions in Shabbos that Rabbi Yeshua ben Korcha was also bold, and therefore he was nicknamed Rabbi Yeshua ben Korcha because his father was bold. Tosfos doesn't like that explanation because why are we calling Rabbi Akiva Korcha, like in a derogatory name like that? Okay, you have a Gemara where Ben Azai calls him that, but Ben Azai at least is a colleague of Rabbi Akiva, and he's calling that as a little bit of a joke. But that we should call Rabbi Akiva Korcha, and that for all generations his son should be named Rabbi Yeshua ben Korcha because of that, Tosfos says it doesn't stick. And there are a few other places where Tosfos discusses this also. I saw an explanation, actually, that what it is Rabbi Akiva, when he married, we find in Obas Rav Nosson, that when he married Rachel, and she convinced him to go and learn Torah, he actually, that says in Obas Rav Nosson, that he went with his son to Cheder. So he and his son are sitting in Cheder together and learning Aleph Beis. Meaning, in other words, that he was previously married, and he was widowed or divorced, and then he married Rachel. So therefore, so this Rabbi Yeshua ben Korcha might have been the son of his from his first marriage. And therefore, he was called Korcha, because at that point, his father, when he was born and when he was growing up, his father was not yet the great Rabbi Akiva. His father was just Sam Akiva, the shepherd. And afterwards, Akiva, the one who's now learning in Cheder or whatever. So therefore, they nicknamed him Korcha, and therefore the name stuck. Anyway, whether this Rabbi Yeshua is Rabbi Yeshua, is the son, whether this Rabbi Yeshua is Rabbi Yeshua ben Korcha or not, at any rate, he is the son of Rabbi Akiva. So Rabbi Akiva gave him 7 pieces of advice. Number one, B'ni, al teshev begoyva shal ir v'tishneh. Number one, he says, my son, don't sit in the heights of the city and teach Torah. Now, what's wrong with the heights of the city? Rashi and the Rashbam say because it's a place where people are always walking by. So that way, it's going to distract you from learning because people are always going by. Now, there's another idea also the Gemara mentions in Sukkah that Torah should be taught with a little bit of privacy. You do want to have, you should, of course, be teaching Torah publicly, but it shouldn't just be like something like a casual thing that you just have in front of everybody. It should be in a Beis Medrash or some appropriate setting like that. So therefore, it's also in that sense that if you do it with Goyva Shalir, then it's like demeaning the Torah a little bit, as though it's like something that, as though it's like a rock concert or something that should just be out in the open in front of everybody. Ben Yehoyada has an interesting take on it. He says, the vort is, the lower parts of the city tend to be very dirty because all the filth and everything winds up over there because of gravity. On the other hand, the highest part of the city, it's cleaner over there, but it's also very windy, so it's more likely to be distracting. So therefore, he's telling him, you should sit and teach Torah in the middle parts of the city where you don't have either of those problems. You don't have all the dirt and filth and everything, and you also don't have the high winds. Okay, that's number one. Number two, Ba'al Todor Be'ir Sharasheh Tamar HaChamim. Number two, don't live in a city where the heads of the city are Tamar HaChamim. Now, what's wrong with that? The reason is, Rashi and Rashbam say, because Tamar HaChamim are busy learning Torah, therefore they're not going to be able to focus properly on Milud Tzibura, on matters of the Tzibur. There's actually a sicha in Tavshin Memches where the Rebbe Shteldzich on this, and also on a similar piece that the Gemara is going to say at the top of Kuf Yud Gimel Amud Aleph, a similar piece of advice. So what? So the heads of the city, the mayor and the city council, whatever, should be Amei Ha'aretz? Obviously not. So the point is that you have two different kinds of Tamar HaChamim. You have the kind who look at the Torah and figure out from there what should be done for society. And then you have the other way around. They look at society and figure out what it needs according to Torah. So the Gemara is telling us look for the second kind of Tamar HaChamim, the ones who are able to see what society needs and not obviously they're not going to change the Torah, you know, they're not going to change and alter the Torah to fit that, Chas v'Shalom, but at least, in other words, they're looking from the perspective of, you know, there is a world out there, there is a world that the Eved Shtah created that has certain needs and certain wants, and what can we do, Alpi Torah, in order to make that work, in order to make it a din of a tachtonim, rather than you sit kind of in the ivory tower of Torah and look at what Torah says on a sort of like on a theoretical level and try to apply that to the needs of the city, and it doesn't always work. It doesn't always work in practice. You have the rare Talmid Chachamim, of course, who are able to do that way, but most of them are not. Okay. That was the second piece of advice. Number three, Valtikonis the base chapisaim. Don't go suddenly into your house, always knock first. Kosha came the base chavercha, how much more so into somebody else's house that you shouldn't just barge in, knock first. In fact, the Rashbam points out, you have this week's parasha, you had the me'il of the Kohen Gadol with the bells on the bottom of it. The point was, the Nishma Kola b'vori al HaKodesh, like you have, so to speak, the bells are like announcing his presence before he comes in. So similarly, you should knock before you, and, or announce yourself before you come in, even into your own house, much less into somebody else's house, especially because the Rashbam says they might be doing something that needs privacy. So there you just barge in, and then you're barging in on their privacy. So even if it's your own house. Number four, the al timna min olim miraglacha. Number four, don't hold back shoes from your feet. In other words, you should always be wearing shoes. It's a gnai for a Talmid Chacham to go barefoot. And in fact, the Gemara in Shabbos, we learned a few months ago, says that a person should always even sell everything that he has, even the beams of his house, and buy shoes for his feet. So therefore, Rabbi Akiva is telling that to Rabbi Yeshua ben Torcha. Number five, Hashkev to Rabbi Yeshua, to his son Rabbi Yeshua, whether it's Rabbi Yeshua ben Torcha or not. Number six, Hashkev ve'echo, number five, rather, Hashkev ve'echo, v'kayetz mipneh hamo, v'chodef mipneh sinah. Always wake up and eat early in the summer because of the heat and in the winter because of the cold. In other words, if you eat breakfast, then it helps strengthen you so that the heat or the cold won't affect you and make you sick. The Rashbam refers to a Gemara in Bava Kamma that brings psukim to that effect, that if a person eats breakfast, then it helps keep away sicknesses from them. Number six, v'aseh Shabbat hachor v'atitzarach adrias. What we just said, make your Shabbos a weekday rather than having to go and take tzedakah from people with the conditions that we said before. And number seven, Rabbi Akiva tells Rabbi Yeshua, behevim mishtadlim im odim shashom esachek esloi, always make an effort to get together with a person who the hour is smiles on him, in other words, who has good mazel at this time. So what does that mean, that last one? Amar Papa, loy le mizban minei v'loy le zabuni lei. It doesn't mean that you should be selling to him or buying from him, because Faket, if he has the good mazel, then he's always going to come out with the better end of the deal. Ella lemevad shutfus bahadei. Rather, it means if you see a person who has good mazel and obviously also has good midas and whatever, try to enter a partnership with him, and that way his mazel will also rub off on you. Not rub off, but whatever. His mazel will be good for the partnership, and that way it'll be good for you as well. But the Gemara continues, v'hashta the Amr of Shmuel by Yitzchak. Now, actually, that of Shmuel by Yitzchak said, a drasha on the pasuk, my destiv, my se yoder beidachta. What does it mean? At the beginning of Sefer Iyov, when the Satan and Hashem are talking, and Hashem says to the Satan, have you seen Iyov? What do you think of him? And the Satan says, you know, of course he's such a tzaddik and a tom v'yosho and everything, because he has all the good in the world, so therefore he has nothing to complain about. Therefore, he's serving Hashem not me'ava, but just out of selfish reasons. And therefore, the Satan convinces the Eved Shtah to allow him to test Iyov. Anyway, he uses the expression, Masa yoder beidachta, you bless the work of his hands. So Rav Shmuel Bar Yitzchak explains that what that means is kolam noto pruta me'iyov misparich. Anybody who would take even a pruta from Iyov would get a bracha as a result of that, because Iyov was such a great guy that even the money that he gave to people had a bracha on it. Which, by the way, is a source for where, when the Rebbe started giving out dollars in many years before that, when the Rebbe would give out nickels and dimes or whatever, is based on this idea, kolanoto pruta me'iyov misparich, that just the act of taking a coin or taking money from a tzaddik itself gives a bracha. So once we have that, then when we're talking about the person, It doesn't mean davka that it has to be like Rav Papa said, make a partnership with him. Even if all you're doing is getting money from him, is buying from him, or is buying from him or selling to him, which involves money exchange, money or goods exchange in hands, shaper dummy, then it's fine. You'll also get a bracha that way, just like people got a bracha from receiving a coin from Eiv. Since we're talking about advice that Rabbi Akiva gave his son, Rabbi Yeshua, and one of those pieces of advice tied into what we said before, because it was the advice, I say Shabbat Chachol, Baal Tetzarech Labrius, that better make your Shabbos like a weekday rather than having to take tzedakah from people. So the Gemara digresses to tell us another example of advice that Rabbi Akiva gave somebody else, and then we're going to talk about other pieces of advice that various Chachamim gave their Talmidim or their children. So Chamisha Dvarim Tzivah Rabbi Akiva as Rav Shimon Yochai Kshahoya Chovosh Pavei Ha'asurim. When Rabbi Akiva was in jail, and you know the famous story that he was teaching Torah, we learned it in Brachas, that he was teaching Torah in public and the Romans came and arrested him. So during that time, for a period of time there at least, the Romans did allow his Talmidim to visit him in jail. So at one point Rav Shimon Yochai came to visit. So Kshahoya Chovosh Pavei Ha'asurim, when Rabbi Akiva was in jail, Amalai, so Rav Shimon says to Rav Akiva, Rebbe, lamdeini Torah, teach me Torah. Omar, so Rav Akiva said a very surprising thing. Eini melamedcha, I'm not going to teach you Torah, because it would be dangerous. Now, what do you mean? Rav Akiva himself had gone on Mesiras Nefesh to teach Torah. So one possibility is Rav Akiva needed to do that in order to spur the Olam to learn Torah, because like this with the Xavis of the Romans, people were likely to slap off on it. Therefore, Rav Akiva had to make a public example of it. But now that public example was made, then maybe he didn't need to make such an effort of it anymore. The other possibility, as we're going to see in the Gemara over here, is he didn't want to put Reb Shimon in danger. There is actually an interesting idea that Dordus HaRishonim is a sefer that analyzes various episodes in Jewish history and has long discussions about them. And he analyzes this story over here. He says maybe the verdict was when Rabbi Akiva was originally teaching Torah in public and the whole story of Papus Ben Yehuda and the marshal with the fox and the fish, the verdict was the Romans weren't yet executing people for teaching Torah. They were arresting them. So fine, Rabbi Akiva said, fine, that chance I can take. But now already the shmad had intensified, and now the Romans are going to be executing people for teaching Torah. So therefore, Rabbi Akiva felt it's too much of a danger to put Rabbi Shimon in to have him, that he might not only be arrested, but that he might actually be killed by the Romans. That's too much of a risk to take. So he said, I'm not going to teach you Torah. Amaloi, so Rabbi Shimon answers back also with a very surprising statement. He says, "In ein atem alam deni, if you don't teach me Torah, ani omer leyechoi abba, I will tell my father Yehoi, Lamalchus, and he will hand you over to the government." Now, what do you mean by that? First of all, what kind of a thing is that to say to your Rebbe that I'm threatening you that my father was going to hand you over to the government? And second of all, he's already in the hands of the government. He's already arrested. What exactly is Reb Shimon saying by that? So Tamar Shah says, okay, you know, he might have just been exaggerating. Like he's saying, in other words, I'll have my father Yehoi tell the Romans that you did even worse crimes, and they'll put you in even under a stronger arrest than you are now. Obviously, he doesn't mean it sincerely. He's saying it like in an exaggerated way. How much he wants to learn Torah. There is an explanation, actually. The Rabbi Yaakov Emden says on our Gemara, and Dordus HaRishonim explains in greater detail that what it was is this Yehoi, Rabbi Shimon's father, had connections with the government. So he was managing to get the Romans to treat Rabbi Akiva relatively leniently, for example, to have Talmidim visit him. So Rabbi Shimon is telling him that if you don't teach me Torah, then I'll tell my father Yehoi, and he'll stop his efforts on your behalf, and therefore you'll wind up in a worse situation than you are now. Again, obviously, it would be very, 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 very chutzpahdik to actually threaten your Rebbe that way, but he means it like an exaggerated way to show how much he wants to learn Torah. Or it could also mean, he'd tell his father Yehoi, this is how Dordus HaRishonim explains it, it's not really an empty threat. He's saying, I'll tell my father Yehoi that you're not teaching Torah. So automatically, therefore, my father is going to figure, you know what then, why am I bothering? What am I putting in so much effort and money and whatever else into getting the Romans to treat Rabbi Akiva leniently, where the whole reason is so he should still be able to teach Torah, but if he's not going to anyway, then why am I bothering? And therefore, like, he's not going to work on it as hard as before, and therefore Rabbi Akiva is going to end up in a worse situation. Anyway, Amar Loi, said Rabbi Akiva, tells him, it's not that I don't want to teach you Torah. Bni, says, my son, Beyond
the anecdote with Reb Shimon, what is halacha? If you're in Takana, are you allowed to teach Torah or not? I mean, that's an important point.
It is an important point, and I guess the answer is, I mean, that, you know, obviously we have the example of Rav Akiva teaching Torah when he was going to get arrested. We have the examples of Hasidim in Russia, for example, teaching Torah, even though they could get arrested and killed for it. It depends on a lot of factors, I guess. I mean, in this case, Rav Akiva figured maybe that Rav Shimon is already a mature Talmud on his own. He doesn't need, I mean, he of course, a person needs to learn Torah throughout their life. But maybe Rav Shimon doesn't need to put himself in danger in order to do it, where he could just as well do it under other circumstances where it would be safer. Whereas, let's say, for example, the Chassidim had Chadarim in Russia. If they don't do that, if they don't teach the children, then the children aren't going to have a chance to learn anywhere else. So therefore, maybe there's more of a reason to be Moshe Nefesh over there. But yeah, it's you're right. It's not so simple.
So what's the basic bottom line? If they threaten to kill a Jew if he teaches Torah, or he learns Torah, what's the halacha?
Well, one big thing to factor in is whether it's a shas hashmad. Is it a time like it was in this time, for example, with Rebbe Akiva, or like it was with the communists in Russia, where they're actually trying to outlaw Torah? Then the din is you go on Mesiras Nefesh for any mitzvah, including learning Torah. So in this case, Rabbi Akiva himself doesn't have a problem going on Masiris Nefesh, but he doesn't want to endanger Rabbi Shimon unnecessarily.
Well, in the time of the Nazis, let's say.
The time of the Nazis is also a Shas HaShmad. They're trying to wipe out the Jewish people altogether, Rahman al-Fan. So then, yeah, you go on Masiris Nefesh for even lesser mitzvahs, yeah.
But they tried to destroy the Jewish people whether or not they teach Torah.
This is true, but they were also, I mean, they were, you know, they mainly were out to get Jews who are learning Torah and keeping mitzvahs. I mean, once they were doing that, yeah, they also had their various racial theories and they're trying to get Jews who are not doing that either. But, you know, the fact of the matter is there are many places in Europe where Jews who converted or were married to Goyim or whatever were generally speaking better off and safer than ones who weren't. So, you know, there was definitely a strong element of being against Judaism, not just against Jews, in what the Nazis were doing. Sure. All right. Well, let's discuss that later if we want. Let's go on. Okay. Amaloi, so Rabbi Akiva tells him, Bni, my son, Yosim Masha Ha'ego Roitzalina, even more than the calf wants to be able to nurse from its mother, Para Roitzalahonik, even more so the cow wants to be able to nurse its baby. In other words, I want to teach Torah even more than you want to learn Torah, but I'm afraid of putting you in danger. Amaloi, said Rav Shimon, says, Umi v'sakana, after all, who is the one really in danger? V'haloi ego v'sakana, to continue your metaphor, it's the calf that's in danger. It's me, in other words, who's in danger. Fine, I'm willing to take that risk. Amaloi, said Rav Akiva, told him, okay, then I'll tell you certain things, I'll tell you certain pieces of advice in Torah. Number one, im bikash lechonik he tola be'ilan gadol. If you want to be choked, then hang yourself on a tall tree. Which means, in other words, Rashi and the Rashbam say, it means if you want to teach people something in Torah and you want them to accept it, then what you should do is tell them it in the name of a great Talmud Chacham. So in other words, the Rashbam explains the first part of the metaphor, im bikash lechonik, is not really, I mean, it doesn't really fit the nimshol that you want people to accept what you're saying. But the reason is because he's continuing with the expression, he told of the ilan gadol, hang yourself on a tall tree. In other words, attribute what you're saying to a great Talmud Chacham. Therefore, he uses the beginning of the mashal, he uses the expression, if you want to be choked, in other words, in order to go with the second half of it. But it means, in other words, that Rashbam says, learn by a great Rebbe, and say over teachings of Torah in his name, and that way people will accept it. Rashi actually seems to say it a little bit differently, which is that say it in the name of an Adam Gadol, and the implication Rashi seems to be saying is even if that Adam Gadol didn't actually say it, nevertheless you can attribute it to him in order that people should accept it. Now, there is a lot of discussion about that, because how are you allowed to do that? You have, first of all, it's lying, and you actually have something in Masechta Kala that says that if a person does that, he causes the Shechina to go away from the Jewish people. There's a lot of different answers. One of them, one of the most basic answers being, It depends on what caliber of Talmud Chacham you are. If you're not such a high caliber Talmud Chacham, don't do that. Don't attribute something to a greater Chacham that he didn't actually say, because maybe you're misunderstanding. Maybe he wouldn't have said that. You're coming up with some svara, but not necessarily would that Chacham have subscribed to that svara. But if you're a great caliber Talmud Chacham, which of course Reb Shimon ben Yochai was, then he has the ability to do that, to say something when he wants that people should accept what he's saying, to attribute it to a greater Talmud Chacham, even if that Talmud Chacham didn't say it, because that Talmud Chacham would agree with, you can assume that Talmud Chacham would agree with that idea. Or maybe it means only if he didn't say it b'feirush, but he said something from which you could infer that, then you could quote it as if he actually said it, because you could infer from something else that he said. Anyway, that's all according to Rashi and the Rashbam. Rabbi Nachmanel and the Aruch have a bit of a different understanding of it. They say it means if you need to know something about a Dvar Isser, about a matter of Isser Beheter, ask the great Chacham, which is like a tall tree, and follow what he says. The Aruch says a little bit similarly that it means, in other words, that if you're going to be paskening on a severe matter, on a matter of Isser Veheter, or a matter of Din Nefashos, or something which has severe consequences, make sure that you ask an Adam Gadol, make sure that you ask the great Talmud Chacham what his opinion is, and follow that rather than coming up with a svara on your own. Okay. That's number one. Number two, Reb Akiva tells Reb Shimon, "Ochshatem alamedes bincha." When you're teaching your son, lamdehu b'sefer muga, teach him from a sefer, from a scroll that is corrected, that doesn't have mistakes in it. So the Gemara says, "Maihi." What specifically are we talking about? Amar Ramavi, Tamer Amashavshia b'chavuta. We mean when the child is first starting to learn something new. And you have to make extra sure that the svarim that you're learning from are accurate and don't have mistakes. The shabeshta given to all, because if you teach him with a mistake to begin with, once he learns it with a mistake, that mistake is likely to stay with him for life. So you have to be careful at the beginning. Like the beginning of the learning is like the roots of the tree. Everything depends on that. It's like a seed. Everything depends on that. So you have to make sure that the seed and the roots are as good as possible in order that the later learning will also be good. So here, in other words, if you teach him from a sefer, let's say from a sefer Torah, that has a mistake in it, he's going to grow up thinking that mistaken version is correct, and he's not going to realize to change that even when he gets older. Tosfos points out over here in particular, where here every time he's going to refer back to that sefer, and he's going to say, see, it says this in the sefer, and not realize that sefer actually has a mistake in it. The Gemara in Baba Basra tells us a story involving Yoav, where Rebbe taught him wrongly about Zecher Amalek, and it had very serious consequences later on when Yoav was David's general and he fought against Edom and didn't do a complete job wiping them out. So we see how important it is to be careful that what you're teaching a child in the first place is as accurate, is very, very accurate. Next, the third piece of advice that Rabbi Akiva tells Reb Shimon, Loisa Vasha Bikdera Shabishabo Chaveracha. Don't cook in a pot where another person cooked in it. So mind you, what does Rabbi Akiva mean by that? He means Grusha Bachaye Baiva. He means don't marry a divorced woman while her first husband is still alive. And the reason is, the Omer Mar, because we learn in a Braita, Gorush Shenosa Grusha, if a divorced man marries a divorced woman, Arba Deis Bemita, then in effect you have four thoughts in the bed, because when they're in bed together, then he's thinking about his first wife, she's thinking about her first husband, and you're not allowed to do that. Children that come from such relations are almost like mamzerim. I mean, they're not actually mamzerim mahalacha, of course, but it's called grusha salev, and the Gemara in Dorim tells us it's a very bad thing. So therefore, in other words, Rav Akiva is telling Rav Shimon, so if you marry a divorced woman, then she's going to still be thinking about her first husband, and that creates problems. Whereas, as opposed to, if her husband died, then Ben Yehoyada points out, look, you know, the Gemara tells us in a few places that the Eveshta made a Gzeira, we learned it actually earlier in our Masechta as well, that eventually the dead are forgotten. So eventually, with time, she's going to forget her first husband, therefore you don't have a problem. But when she's divorced and her husband's still alive, then you have a problem. The Gemara continues, V'iboyis Eimer, another possibility is Afila Ba'almana. Maybe Rav Akiva is even talking about a widow, not just a divorcee where there's a problem that she still may think about her first husband, but even an Almana. L'fisha ain't kol es bo'is trabos, because not all the fingers are the same, which are the finger is a euphemism for the Eva Tashmish. In other words, what happens is, you know, you're a different side than her first husband, even though her husband is dead. So therefore, so Rashi says that she's going to think less of you because you're not the same as her first husband. Rashbam says even stronger tisnoi, so she may resent you. So therefore, it's better not to do that. Next, the fourth piece of advice that Rabbi Akiva gives Rabbi Shimon, mitzvah beguf gadol, a mitzvah that where you're accomplishing a great mitzvah and you also have a way of earning money from it, is oichol peiros v'loy sachar, is to eat peiros without schar. What is this? Rashi and the Rashbam explain that we're talking about an arrangement. The Gemara in Bava Metzia calls it mashkanta de surah. And so the mashkanta, the mortgage that they used to do in Surah. So the way it is you lend money to somebody. Now, obviously, you're not allowed to take ribis, and there's all kinds of ribis. There's ribis d'araisa, there's ribis d'rabbanon. What you do is, there's an arrangement that they used to do in Surah, which the Gemara tells us, the halacha is allowed. You make an arrangement with the guy. Let's say you figure like this. You say that, here, I lent you $1,000. For the next 10 years, I'm going to take and eat the produce of your field is going to belong to me. Now, that produce is usually available at a discount. So you figure out, let's say the produce of the field is $100 per year. So after 10 years, then the whole loan will be paid off. But what often happens is you end up having more produce than expected. So therefore, you end up gaining from it. But it's not considered ribis for reasons that the Gemara discusses over there in Bava Metzia, basically because it boils down to it's a sale really rather than a loan. And also because you're taking a risk, because after all, the field can always have bad years. There can be years of drought, locusts, or what have you. So therefore, it's not considered ribis. But like this, generally speaking, you stand to earn a profit from it. So like this, you're accomplishing a great mitzvah. You're lending somebody money, which is a big mitzvah, in kesef tal v'asami. And you also stand to earn some money from it if as is usually the case, the produce ends up being worth more than they arranged in the first place. And the fifth piece of advice, Rabbi Akiva tells Rabbi Shimon, mitzvah beguf tahor, how do you have a mitzvah where you also have a pure body, is noisa isha v'loy banim, you marry a woman and have children. The Mephoshim over here don't explain in detail what that means. Rav Moshe actually has in one of his Truvas, he has two explanations of it. One is it means poshut, you get married and you have children, and that way you have the advantage, you have the mitzvah of pruvu, and you have guf tahor because since you're married, you're not going to have taivas for other women or taivas for znus or whatever because you'll be able to be with her. The other explanation is he says it means that you marry even if you already have children from a previous marriage. Nevertheless, it's good to get married again because then you have a mitzvah from it and you have a guf tahor because again, as long as a man is single, then he's going to have taivus, which is hard for him to do anything about in a way that's mutter. Whereas if he gets married, then he has a way of fulfilling those taivus in a way that's mutter and therefore staying tahor.
Even if he's mekayim the mitzvah here in Rivia.
So even if he was already Mekayim, that's the point. The point of Moshe's second explanation, which he says is the more preferred one, is that's what it means. Even then, he should still try to get married, if possible, because that way he'll have a guf tahor. Yeah. Okay. So those were the five pieces of advice that Rabbi Akiva gave Rabbi Shimon. Next,
these examples were examples, but it wasn't considered learning because, right? No, it was the
I guess in that sense, right? It's not like actual learning, like they're sitting down over a sugya in Gemara or something. Yeah, because I guess Rabbi Akiva still felt that might be too dangerous. At least like this, if the guards overhear them or something, then okay, you know, I'm giving him advice for life. Yeah, I guess. Yeah. Okay. Next, Rabbeinu HaKadosh, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, gave the following four pieces of advice to his sons. Or to his son, it says on the side, one son. Number one, al todo b'shchansiv. Number one, don't live in the city of Shchansiv. Mishum de leitzoni habu, because the people in Shchansiv are leitzonim. They're people, they're mockers. They like to make fun of everything that's important. Umosh hulach b'leitzonusa. So they're going to draw you into their leitzonis. Now, children of Rabbeinu HaKadosh are going to be susceptible to that. Ben Yehoyada has an interesting point on it. He says what the people in Shchansiv would do is they would come to the local dayan with a question in halacha, which on the face of it was a legitimate question, but really they were doing it only in order to make fun. They were doing, they would, let's say, make up a case. They would make up a case and present it to the Rav as if it was a real case. And then that way afterwards they could have a good laugh at how they put one over on the Rav or whatever it is. So therefore, Rabbi Yehuda Anasi tells his son, don't live in that place, because what's going to happen? You're going to be the Rav there. They're going to come and ask you these kinds of made-up shailas, and then, if nothing else, you're going to be wasting time on their litzanus, and it may even be that you're actually drawn into their litzanus, where, in other words, you think that that what they're saying is legitimate, and you think of them as some of the chachamim, and then start associating with them too much. That's one. Number two, Rebbe tells his children, "Va'al teishav al mitas haramis." The second piece of advice, don't sit on the bed of an Arami woman, of a Goyish woman. Now, what does that mean? So there's a few different explanations. Ika da'amri v'le tigni v'le krishma. One explanation, it means don't go to sleep without krishma, because then you're going to sleep the way a Goy goes to sleep. The ika da'amri Deloitinsa Giyota. Another explanation is it means don't marry a Giyotis, because that would mean the bed of a Goyish woman. So now she's not a Goyish woman anymore. Obviously, she's a Giyotis. But still, the problem is, in particular, the Gemara tells us in Sanhedrin that you have to be very careful. Well, we know Bechlal, the Torah tells us in a bunch of places that you're not allowed to hurt a Ger's feelings. So Bechlal, you might have, it's more likely if you're married to a Giyotis, there's more likely that the husband at some point is gonna hurt his wife's feeling, and therefore for a Giyotis, it's a more severe thing. The Rashbam also adds that the Gemara tells us in Sanhedrin that for that a Ger, even down to the 10th generation, you shouldn't make fun of Goyim in his presence, because still, even up to 10 generations later, he still feels a certain affinity towards that nation that he comes from, and therefore he's going to take it badly when you do that. And it's much harder. Jews talk among themselves. You sometimes talk in a derogatory way about the Goyim and make fun of them or whatever. And it's very hard to be careful with that when you're married to a Giyotis, and then that's going to hurt her feelings. So therefore, better not to do that. Obviously,
but he got a mitzvah, he's got a bigger mitzvah of a half to mitzvah ger all the time.
So if you're able to accomplish it, yeah, but you're accomplishing a bigger mitzvah of a half to mitzvah ger. Listen, I mean, we have, for example, Boaz married Ruth. Yeshua married Rahab. Obviously, we're not saying as a blanket statement that you should never marry a Giyotis, but other things being equal, there are these potential pitfalls with it. Okay. The Ikka Da'amri, then a third understanding of this explanation, Al Teisho, Al Mitzah Saramis, means the Ikka Da'amri, Al Mori Samish. A third explanation, it means exactly what it sounds like. Don't sit on the bed of a Goyish woman. Or Mishamaisa, the Rapapa, and the reason why not is because of a story involving Rapapa. Rashi and the Rashbam both tell the story that Rapapa one time had lent a lot of money to a Goyish lady. So he was coming to her house every so often to demand the debt. One time, she killed her child. She put the child under the bed. And then when her papa came in, she invited him to sit down on the bed and come sit down. I'll bring you your money. Then, so he sat down over there. Then she all of a sudden comes running back into the room screaming, "You killed my child." And they looked up the bed. And sure enough, there's this dead child underneath. And her papa was forced to run away. So therefore, so according to this, Rebbe, now of course Rebbe lived a few hundred years before the Papa, but nevertheless, the point is he was giving his son's advice, which later was borne out in the story of the Papa, that there's a danger in sitting on a Goyish woman's bed. Now it's interesting, actually, that in Brachos, the Gemara tells that story, Rashi tells the story over there in Brachos differently, that actually, the Gemara itself tells a little bit differently, that Rapapa himself realized what might be going on and picked up the bed. He said, "I'm not sitting down on the bed unless you pick it up first." And he picked it up and found the dead baby, and therefore he was saved from this alila, from this false accusation that she was going to do against him. So here we're saying that on the other hand, he wasn't saved and he actually had to run away. So there's a few possibilities. One of them being that this story may have happened with Rapapa more than once. It may have happened that this happened to him once, and therefore, the next time, he knew to be careful and to check in advance to make sure that he doesn't end up in this situation again. Fine. So that was Rebbe's second piece of advice, not to sit on the bed of an Arami woman, and again, we had three explanations of what that meant. The third piece of advice, Don't try to evade tax collectors. Because they might end up catching up to you. The shackling enough called the islah, and they'll take away everything that you have. Now, the Gemara does tell us in other places, in particular in Bava Kama, that the chlal, you're not allowed to evade taxes because dinah de malchus dinah. The government is entitled to collect a certain amount of taxes and you have to pay it and you're not allowed to cheat them on it. So one possibility is we're talking about, about the kind of tax collectors that they had in those days, who often would collect much more than the government entitles them to. And in fact, in many places, the Gemara calls them for that, Rishoyim and Gazlonim. So the halacha, you are allowed to try to evade them because they're not collecting legitimate taxes. But nevertheless, Rebbe is telling his sons, practical advice, don't try to evade them because you may end up worse off than you otherwise would. The other possibility is maybe even there's an explanation from Rabbi Avraham Elia Kaplan, who was a great Talmud Chacham who lived in the 19th century. He was Nifter young. He was Rosh Shiva, and he was a Rosh Shiva in Berlin for a few years and passed away young. Anyway, he gives an explanation that maybe taka means actual legitimate government taxes. Okay, dinah de malchus dinah. It doesn't mean necessarily that maybe dinah de malchus dinah doesn't necessarily apply. You know, you do have to pay them, but maybe you're entitled to avoid them and evade them where possible. But nevertheless, Rebbe is telling his son, don't do that because practically speaking, they may end up getting it. Okay, number four. And the fourth piece of advice that Rebbe gives his sons, don't stand in front of a bull or in the presence of a bull when it's coming up from the meadow. Because the sultan is dancing between his horns, which in other words, the Rashbam says, is a way of saying, in other words, the ox is feeling very, very comfortable and very expansive and goes a little bit crazy. And in fact, the Gemara continues on that. Amr of Shmuel, the Shor Shachar remain over Yom Nissan. We're talking specifically about a black ox during Nissan time. The point is that during Nissan, fresh grass is growing. So now, like the ox is feeling very expansive, feeling very comfortable. It's spring. There's grass all over the place. I have plenty to eat. So therefore he goes a little bit crazy. The Rashbam doesn't explain why Dafka a black ox, but the Marsha has an explanation, has a deeper explanation that the black ox over here represents actually. So what you have is during Nissan, we know that the mazel of Nissan is mazel tzver, the sheep. And what happened during Nissan in the year of Yetzias Mitzrayim, the power of that mazel, which in particular we know the Egyptians worshipped sheep, the power of that mazel was broken. Well, what happened was, the unfortunate result of that was that the Jewish people started thinking that in that case, that gives more power to the next mazel. The mazel of Ir is the mazel of Shur, and that led to the Cheta Eagle, which an eagle, after all, is a baby Shur. And therefore, therefore that's represented over here by the black ox, because what happened is, Hushcharu Pneim, the Jewish people's faces, were turned black and embarrassed because of that Cheta Eagle. So therefore, so in that sense, like there's a certain connection between an ox and Nissan. In other words, don't think because Yetzias Mitzrayim, everything's good. Therefore we can do whatever we want. We can get careless. You always have to be careful and realize that there's a virus lurking that you have to watch out for. So in this connection, Tony Rav Oshia, Marchikin Mishur Tam Chamishim Amma, you have to stay at least 50 amas away from an ox that's a tam, where it hasn't yet gored three times. Mishur Muad Kim Loy Enav. And from a Shur Muad, you have to stay as far away as you can see it. We learned this in Brachas as well, by the way, and the Gemara mentioned it as something where even if you're in the middle of Shemana Esrei and you see a Shur Muad coming, then you can interrupt Shemana Esrei and move away, because otherwise you could be in danger. Tonim Shmeidet a Meir, and we learned in a Braisa in the name of a Meir, Resh Turna B'dikula, even if the ox's head is inside the feed bag, so in other words, it's busy eating from a bag around its neck. And so you'd think it's distracted, so it's not going to pay any attention to you. Still, Sakla Igra, go up to the roof, Bashodi Daga Mitutah, and throw down the ladder from behind you. In other words, it's an exaggerated way of saying that you have to stay as far away. Obviously, the ox is not going to climb a ladder, but it's an exaggerated way of saying, be very, very careful. Keep the utmost distance from a shur, because otherwise he may gore. Okay, speaking of oxen, Amar Rav, Nizha de Torah Hein Hein. The the lachash to use for an ox is heinhe. So Rashi explains it in the lachash to prevent it's a spell to keep an ox from goring a person is to say the word heinhe. The Rashbam disagrees and says that no, it means in other words when you need to scare up when you need to get an ox to go someplace, so like a sort of like with a horse you tell him giddy up or whatever. So with an ox you tell him hein hein, for example, to get him away or to get him to do work. Then you use an expression like that hein hein on it. Nidha de Aryeh, the same thing for a lion, according to Rashi, to prevent it from attacking you, and according to the Rashbam, to get it to work, or to get it to go away, or whatever, is you say zeh, zeh. Nidha de Gamla, the words to use for a camel, is da, da. Nidha de Arba, when it comes to a ship, so you have, let's say, people are trying to get a ship moving, then you say hilmi haya hila vehila kulya. So, I mean, on the surface, I mean, it means exactly what it sounds like, that these are words that are known to be effective against, against, or to get to work these different kinds of creatures. But the Meshech Chochmah has an interesting take on it. He says, in general, there's two kinds of Yetzaharas that can be bothering a person. You have Yetzaharas for Tivus, which are like an animal, and then you have Yetzaharas about thoughts of Kfiro, whatever, thoughts against Yiddishkeit that are more like the human side of the person based on his thoughts. So we're saying, for animals, all you need is, we're saying over here, for each one, for these different animals, you just repeat the same word again and again. You just take some word, some vort or toto, whatever, and repeat it to yourself as many times as necessary in order to get rid of that animalistic Yetzirah. On the other hand, when it comes to a Yetzirah that involves thoughts, that involves thoughts and that involves ideas against Torah, then you need, like we have in the Gemara over here, various words. You need many different arguments and many different things. Try to figure out whatever logical arguments you can in order to get rid of that Yetzirah. There's an explanation from Rabbi Yaakov of Lisa, one of the great Achronim in the times of the Tzemach Tzedek. He lived approximately. And also Ben Yehoyada says something similar, that the ox represents, for example, a powerful Russia. So you tell it, or maybe actually on the contrary, a powerful tzaddik. So you tell him, hein, hein, yes, yes, I'll do whatever you want. But like, don't stir it up with him. So the ox therefore represents, let's say, a powerful Russia. So you just tell him yes, but don't start up with him. The lion, you tell him zeh zeh, meaning this, the lion representing a great Talmud Chacham, I'll do exactly what you say, and so forth with the other ones. Okay. More advice for life. Amar Abaya, dog, v'kois chamin ubeitzim v'kinim levonim, v'kois chamin ubeitzim v'kinim levonim, these six things: a skin, a fish, a cup, hot water, eggs, and white rice, kulam koshin the davar acher, all of them are bad for you, all of them can cause a person to develop davar acher, which is tzaras. Not necessarily the kind of tzaras that we have, the kind that you show to a kohen, but a similar skin disease or something. So, what are they? So what does it mean? What does it mean, a skin? It means mandigoni amash for the tzala. A person who sleeps on a skin that was on a skin from the tanner, in other words, that the skin is in the process of being turned into leather or parchment, but it's still unfinished. So at that point, if you sleep on it, then it's bad for your skin. Next, dog means shibuta b'yana nissen, means specifically eating a shibuta fish during nissen time. A shibuta is a largish kind of fish. The Gemara mentions it in a few places here and there. Chas, a couple of different possibilities of what it is. Maybe it's a tuna, maybe it's a sole, whatever. So eating it during nissen is bad for you, and it can lead to tzaras. Next, kois, what do we mean by a cup? It means shiure kosa dehausana, leftover kosa dehausana. So we had on Amar Aleph, kosa dehausana is fish fried in its own fat with a little bit of flour. So the leftovers of it are bad for you. So the food itself is good, and it's something to have special for Shabbos if you can't afford anything better. But the leftovers of it are no good. Chamin, hot water, means chamimi. The chamimi, the shadu ilavei, means when a person has very, very hot water poured over him, and that's bad. If he regularly pours over his skin very, very hot water, then it's bad and it can lead to tzaras. Beitzim, what does it mean? Eggs, means mandim madruch hatzlifim. Somebody who steps on eggshells is liable to catch tzaras from that. kinim levonim. What do we mean by white? But what do we mean by white? By white lice? Pashas, that means lice eggs. It means mandem achaver levushay. If a person washes his clothes, he doesn't then keep the clothes off him for 8 days. What if a hodr lavushla, and then he puts it on? What happens is he puts them on within 8 days of washing them. Bayan hanach kinim. Then lice hatch from the eggs. The kosher, the dover acher, and then it's not only that a person has lice, but it's also bad in that it can cause him to develop saras. And then, now, practically speaking, of course, we don't do that nowadays. We don't wait 8 days after we wash our clothes before we wear them. So Ben Yehoyada says we're talking about if you wash them still with the lice on them, then you should leave them for 8 days because you want the lice to be able to die off. They're not gonna be able to live too long off you. But if the clothes to begin with didn't have lice on them, then there's no problem of washing them and then wearing them right away afterwards. Okay. More advice. Amar Papa, Besa de Ispe Shunra, a building or a house or a room where there's a cat in it, loy neova inish boy mason. The person should not go into such a house barefoot without shoes. My time, or why? Mishum de Shunra kota lechinya. Because cats a lot of times kill snakes, the ochelay, and then they eat the snakes. The ispe b'chibir gamikti, snakes have very small bones in them. The e yosef legamer the chibir akari. So if a sanal, a person walks barefoot into a house where there's a cat, then if a bone from the snake, one of these little bones, gets stuck in his foot, loy nafik, it's not going to come out so easily. The istakin lay, and then he can be in danger. Ekadamri, another version is, based on the left space shunner, just the other way around. A house that does not have a cat in it, loy neil ve inish bahakra, a person should not go into such a house while it's dark. My timer, why is that? Jomo michrich bechivya, because a snake might wind itself around his foot, below yada, and he's not going to realize and we're stuck in, and then he's going to be in danger. Whereas if the house has a cat in it, then since the cats regularly eat the snakes, then you have less of a problem. Nowadays, b'chalal, the snakes are not as common in our areas anyway, let alone in our houses, then these pieces of advice are not as negeya on the simple level. Okay. More advice that Chachamim gave to their Talmidim. Gimel Dvarim Tzivir Rabbi Shmuel b'Rabbi Yossi as Rebbe. There are three things that Rabbi Shmuel b'Rabbi Yossi told Rebbe. Now, Rebbe actually was Rabbi Shmuel b'Rabbi Yossi's. What Rebbe was actually the Rebbe of Rabbi Shmuel b'Rabbi Yossi. So Rabbi Shmuel b'Rabbi Yossi is not going to be giving his Rebbe instructions. So on the side of it, he mentions a girsa that's in some Kisvei Yad, and also Ben Yehoyada says it's correct that it's supposed to be Rav, not Rebbe. So Rabbi Shmuel b'Rabbi Yossi, who was a Talmud of Rebbe, gave these instructions to Rav, who was of the following generation. And the simon for them, makash simon, the simon for them for key letters of these three things is the word, the letters makash. Number one, altas mum ba'atzma. Don't make a mum in yourself. Now, what does that mean? It means lo tevelach dina b'hadit flosa. Don't go to a din Torah against three people. Dechad have evolved enough because one of them is going to pose as the litigant, as the one who's against you in Beis Din. Or trei sadi, the other two are going to pose as witnesses. And therefore, you're going to end up losing the case because you have two witnesses against you. Now, they're not allowed to do that on halacha, but unfortunately, not everybody follows halacha, so therefore, don't get involved with three people like that. In fact, Ben Yehoyada says the word mum over here might actually be, it might have been originally a Rosh HaTevis, mem vav mem, which stands for mekach u'memker, so it means don't do mekach u'memker by yourself against three people. Okay, that was the first piece of advice. Number two, v'al tamid al mekach b'shasha ein l'chadonim. Don't stand near a purchase when you don't have money to buy it. Because you're causing him to lose money. Somebody else is going to see, somebody else is going to walk into the store, see that you're looking this thing over, think that you're going to buy it. Meanwhile, so therefore he's not going to try buying it himself. Meanwhile, in the event you didn't buy it, and therefore that you end up with the storekeeper is losing money. There's also another point. I think Ben Yehoyada says also a point about it that you could have the other way around also. The other person may care. He may see that you're trying to buy it, and then in the end, and therefore he's going to try to bid up the price, and therefore he's losing money unnecessarily. So yeah, so don't do that because it's going to cause these it's going to cause these kinds of problems. In fact, Marshall points out, I mean, sometimes you have an actual issue of a nun. Sometimes you have the following halacha: you're not allowed to go into a store, let's say, and ask the price of something where you're not intending to buy it, because that's a nas dvarim. The storekeeper thinks that you're going to buy it, and then in the end, you're not. So here, but here we're talking about even when there's no issue. Sure, if I know, then still don't do it because you're causing the guy to lose money, or you're causing the potential purchaser, the other potential buyer, to lose money or whatever. So that's the second one. Number three, ishtecha tovla. Number three, if your wife toveled, al tizakuf la laila harishayna, don't have relations with her that first night after she toveled. Now, why not? Omer Rab, or Robert says on the side, uben nida daraisa. This applies specifically if she's a nida da'araisa, which we don't have nowadays, because nowadays we have the dinim of taras and mishpacha, we combine together the dinim of nida and zava. But in those times, where the halacha was that even if she bleeds the entire 7 days, then no problem, as long as it ends sometime before shkia, then she can go to the mikveh that night. So, but mayim pasuach. But since already there's a chazaka that the wellspring is open, that she was bleeding earlier that day, it might happen that ziva might take place while they're having relations, and then he's going to have committed a serious aveira. So in other words, nowadays you don't have that issue, because nowadays, anyway, any time a woman bleeds, she needs shiva nikiyim. So therefore, you never have a case where she bled on a certain day, and already that night she's going to the mikveh. So therefore, you don't have this. Adraba, you're supposed to have relations on the night after, on mikveh night. But in those times, if you had a case, now in the normal case, let's say a woman is only bleeding for a couple of days and then she finishes off the 7 days and then she goes to the mikveh the seventh night from when it began, then also no problem. But we're talking about if she was bleeding on the seventh day itself and then she went to the mikveh that night, then Rishma, Rabbi Yossi is saying don't have relations that night because it might be that she'll continue bleeding later on while you're having relations. Let's stop over here and we'll continue tomorrow, Beis Hashem.
The time of the Mishnah, she used to go with her husband on the seventh day of night if she didn't bleed.
So what it was is like this, Nida Raisa, there's Nida and there's Zav. Nida is so you have Macholikus Rishonim, how exactly disciples work, but according to the majority of opinions, everybody except for the Rambam, what it is like this. When a woman bleeds the first time in her cycle, then she becomes a nida. For 7 days, she's a nida, regardless how long the bleeding lasts. So whether it was just a spot, whether it was 1 day, 2 days, 5 days, whatever, she's a nida until the end of the seventh day. So let's say, for example, let's say in a particular monthly cycle, she starts bleeding, let's say, Rosh Chodesh Nisan, Aleph Nisan. So then what would happen is that until up to and including Zion Nisan, she's a nida. So as long as the bleeding stops sometime before Shkia on Zion Nisan, then she goes to the mikveh that night and she's Tohar and Mutar to her husband. Then you have Yemei Ziva.
That's what happened in the time of the Mishnah.
That's what happened when the Torah was given, and in the times of the Mishnah until you had in Rebbe's times they started making takonis. In Rebbe's times they started making takonis to be more machmir on that, and later on in the time of the Gemara they made more takonis, and then you have Benosi Surah Lachmir Al Atzman, and that leads us to what we have nowadays, that whenever a woman bleeds, she needs Shiva Nakiyim. On a Daraisa level, she needs Shiva Nakiyim only if it was during the days of her ziva, which are the 11 days after the Yemei Nida, and it was for 3 days consecutively, then midaraisa, she needs shiva nakiyim. So what we do is we consider, even if it was only a tiny amount of bleeding, we consider as though she was a zava gdola, and regardless when in her cycle it is, and we say she always requires shiva nakiyim.
Today, if she bleeds only during the seventh day, 7 days, you still add another shiva nakiyim.
She still needs shiva nakiyim afterwards. She still needs seven clean days without any bleeding afterwards. So therefore, the concern that we have in this gemara doesn't apply because there's not going to be mayan pasuach. By definition, if she bled that day, she's not going to the mikveh that night because she needs shiva nakiyim.
Well, it goes against the grain of peru remu, because if you add another 7 days, even if she's not a ziva, you're going to decrease her children
most of the time, not. There is sometimes where women have early ovulation, but most of the time, most women cycle. Most women's cycles are long enough. Most women's cycles are long enough, and their nidah bleeding is short enough, an average of 5-6 days or so, that usually mitzvah night comes out the night of her ovulation, or sometimes even a night or two before. There are some women who do have a problem where their ovulation is a couple of days before their mitzvah night, and there are different possibilities that the post can talk about what possibilities there are in order to make it possible for them to get pregnant. But for most women, that's not an issue.
Until I can prove to you, let's say I make a study and I can prove to you that 90% of the women today don't bleed after the seventh day. So what
it doesn't matter. We always consider, especially because there was a machlokes rishonim about how we count the 7 days and the 11 days, we always consider that when a woman bleeds, it's as if it was during the time of Yemei Ziva. And because of a chumrah of Bnei Yisrael, which was accepted universally as halacha, because of that, we always consider as though she was a zava gdola and requires shiva nikki. That's how it is.
What's the machlokes on how to count?
Not a machlokes. There's no machlokes.
No,
there's machlokes was showing him how we count the 7 and 11 days. The question basically boils down to, do we say that immediately after the 11 days begins a new count, or begins a new cycle of 7 days? That's how the Rambam learns it, whereas everybody else, all the other Rishonim, learn that no, what it is the new seven-day cycle begins only the next time she bleeds. In other words, think of it like this. And this isn't really the place for it. The place for this is Masechta Nidah, but I'll explain it briefly. Let's say, for example, a woman's first cycle starts with Chodesh Nisan. So you have 7 days of Nidah and 11 days of Ziva. Fine. Everybody agrees to that. The first 7 days of Nisan are considered the Yemei Nidah. The next days after that, the 8th through the 18th of Nisan, are called the Yemei Ziva, in the sense that if she bleeds during that time, she becomes a Zav. Now, what happens on the 19th of Nisan? According to Rashi and the Ramban and everybody else, we say nothing. The 19th of Nisan is nothing. Any time from the 19th of Nisan onwards, the next time she bleeds is going to begin a new Yemei Nidah. But it doesn't have to be on the 19th. It could be on the 20th, 21st, 22nd. Could be all the way to Rosh Chodesh Iyar. Could be later. Whenever the next time she bleeds will be the new 7 days of Nidah. Whereas the Rambam holds that the 7 and 11 days go consecutively. So according to the Rambam, the 19th of Nisan begins the Yemei Nidah, whether she actually bleeds on that day or not. It's called Yemei Nidah in the sense that if she bleeds any time between the 19th and the 25th, then she's going to be Nidah. But not necessarily that she actually bled during that time. So therefore, it comes out, there are a lot of cases. You think about it, a woman has a regular cycle of 30 days, for example, many times, according to the Rambam, her regular menstrual bleeding is going to be during Yemei Ziva. So whether it's because of that or whether it's because of other reasons, there is already in the times of the Gemara, they made certain takanos about that we treat to a certain extent that we treat women who are nida as though they are zava, and you have on top of that Bnei Yisrael achmiru al atzmon, a chumrah of Bnei that Bnei Yisrael accepted on themselves and which is accepted as black letter halacha, that even if it was only a tiny amount of bleeding, they counted as though it was a zava gdola, as though she bled for 3 days consecutively during the Yemei Ziva, and therefore she needs shiva nikki, and that's how it is. There's no playing around with that.
But according to the Rambam, whatever happens from the 19 days to the 25th, she's nida again.
Well, so no, that I'm going to hold if she doesn't bleed. If she doesn't bleed, obviously she's not nida. But that I'm going to hold that during that time, she's potentially a nida. And then let's say if she bleeds then for the first time on the 26th, then that I'm going to hold that she's a zava. Whereas according to Rashi and the Ramban and everybody else, they would say she's a nida.
So the halacha is like the Rambam, or it's like Rashi and
the halacha is, practically speaking, nowadays it's not negeya, because nowadays, that's the point, we treat all women, whenever they bleed, whether it's a lot or a little or whatever, we always treat them as zavos. So as a practical matter of halacha, it's not negeya.
Well, 1 second, it is negeya after the 19th day, or after the 18th day.
No. The whole point is, any time she bleeds, whether it's the 1st, 2nd, 18th, 25th, 30th, whatever, we always treat her as a zava. She always needs to wait until the bleeding stops and then needs shiva nikiyim after that.
Right. So if she bleeds once during the 7 days, then you add another 7 days, or So you add 11 days, and then what?
And
so she doesn't
days,
drink
actually,
11
five,
days.
5 days plus seven. You always have to. We always have to have 5 days. You always have to have five. The fifth, only on the fifth day after she bleeds can she even start counting the Shiva Nikim. But that's another matter. That's because of other considerations. But whatever. There always needs to be Shiva Nikim after the bleeding. After the bleeding stops. That's always a given. Regardless whether it was during Yemei Nida or during Yemei Ziva.
Right. So there's always
so
Shiva Nikim.
There's no Nafkamina nowadays, whether she's a Nida or a Zava. Either way, whether it was during Yemei Nida or whether it was during Yemei Ziva, we always do exactly the same thing.
Right. So after the 18th day, that's my question.
The
what
next
happens,
time
according to the Rambam,
after the 18th day, she'll be a Zava. That's what we're saying. The next time.
According to the Rambam also?
Never mind according to the Rambam. I'm explaining to you. It doesn't, if not Negea, whether according to Rashi or according to the Rambam. According to the Rambam. As a matter to understand how it is on a Daraisa level, it makes a difference. To understand how it is nowadays, it makes no difference. Everybody agrees that you have to wait until the bleeding stops, and then you have Shiva Nikim. Period. Doesn't matter whether it's on the first day or the 18th day or the whatever. Whatever day she bleeds, you always need Shiva Nikim after that.
Okay, so if she doesn't bleed until her next cycle?
Then she's not Tomei until her next cycle, obviously. Nobody said otherwise. But I'm not going to say she's Tomei automatically on the 19th. If she bleeds on the 19th, or any time from there to the 25th, then she's a Nida. If she bleeds anywhere from the 26th through the 36th, then she's a Zava. But nowadays that we don't distinguish between Nida and Zava, then it doesn't matter.
Okay.
So I'm trying to explain.
Right.
Good.
Well, it has to be. It has to be distilled.
Yeah. So it's important to know what the Rambams and Rashi's and the Ramban's Shittas are as far as the theoretical halacha, as far as to know when, and anyway, to know when the Beis Mikdash is built, when she'll have to bring a korban and when not, because the Zava has to bring a korban. But as a matter of practical halacha, nowadays it's not negeya.
Okay, that's what I was asking.
Good. All right, everyone.